Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. In today's season one finale, we are going to do something a little different. We are traveling back to 2015 and 17 for a double feature of films starring Charlize Theron, Mad Max, Fury Road, and Atomic Blonde.
Inspired by both these films, and without more fuss, let's get to it. I picked Mad Max Fury Road because Izzy hadn't seen it yet.
And I picked Atomic Blonde because it's an awesome movie. And Dad also hadn't seen it yet.
I hadn't seen it yet. All right. So here we go. So here is a brief history of the Mad Max franchise. So the original Mad Max was released in 1979. It was a low-budget, post-apocalyptic tale about a cop fighting a road gang. And he eventually loses his family and everything because of the gang. It did not start out as a post-apocalyptic tale, though. It started out originally, George Miller's idea was to follow a photojournalist who lost his humanity as he traveled from accident to grisly accident and reported on them. This was kind of based on George Miller's experience as a young doctor, how he noticed that the older doctors had become very desensitized to things that happened in the emergency room and in the hospital, and he wanted to kind of make a movie inspired by that. As he started writing the script, making the movie, doing all the things he needed to do, him and his writing partner realized they didn't have the budget to film in Melbourne and have scenes in like hospitals and stuff like that. They can film in abandoned buildings. They can film on the outskirts of towns. They can film on these like lots where it looked kind of run down or not taken care of anymore. So the story shifted to this post-apocalyptic civilization. It really isn't post-apocalyptic if you really watch the film. It's described as post-apocalyptic, but really what it is, it's the last gasp of civilization before civilization collapses. And so that's where the Max in the story is. So at the beginning of the movie, there is this civilization, a very tenuous civilization. And by the end of the movie, you realize Max is on his own and civilization is pretty much done. Then that movie went out. It became a cult favorite. It had really good success internationally, so it inspired George Miller to make Mad Max 2, or in the United States, it was released under the title The Road Warrior in 1981. Miller, in between this time, read some of the critiques from like France and Japan, and he realized the Max character was compared favorably to like the archetypes in American Westerns or samurai films of the lone wanderer. So he read A Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell's, and he shifted Max to more of this universal hero, this universal wanderer. And also inspired by Kurosawa films from Japan, he limited the dialogue to be very essential. He made the film a much more action-driven story. So when people were in another country, they weren't forced to read dialogue. They could just see what the story was and what was going on. So that's why Road Warrior, as I know it, or Mad Max 2, was a much more driven film compared to Mad Max. Mad Max being, it is the origin story of Max, but it's also, there's a lot more of him with his family, a lot more dialogue. It also started George Miller on his epic world building. So when he writes the screenplays, everything in the screenplay has a backstory. So even though you may not know what the backstory is, even though you may not know how the bad guy got there or the head of the oil camp got there, he knows how they got there and why they're there, so everything makes sense. So when you're watching this world and you see his interaction, it feels like a real world because he has a plan for everything. Then in 1985, he made Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. He almost didn't make this film because Byron Kennedy, who was his producer on the first two films, was killed in a helicopter accident when he was scouting for locations for this film. And he was really, you know, grieving, and he didn't know how to do it. But he was directing at that time a miniseries for Australian TV called The Dismissal. And his fellow director and friend, George Ogilvy, was working with him. And he asked George Ogilvy if he could come and support him and help him make the film so George Miller could focus on other aspects of the filmmaking process. In this film, he also introduces Tina Turner's auntie Entity as the leader of Bartertown and Helen Boudet as Savannah Nix, the leader of the Tribe of Lost Children. So there's also, you see women leading and being an active part of the societies that are post-apocalyptic at this point. It truly is, by this time of the series, post-apocalyptic, because there is references to nuclear war, even though it may not be massive nuclear war and other things falling apart. You have the timeline of Mad Max at the end of civilization, Road Warrior, the immediate after effects where everybody's fighting for the remaining resources, and then Beyond Thunderdome, where you're seeing society starting to rebuild and make their own new laws and their own new resources and things like that. And that brings us to Fury Road.
Finally. Oh,
I know. But I felt that was kind of important to go over that, because if people don't know about those first three movies, it's going to be kind of hard to follow.
So he had this idea in 1987. Why did it take him until 2015 to actually make this film?
So George Miller, the director and writer of all of these films, had the original idea for Fury Road in 1987, fairly quickly after Beyond Thunderdome, where he just wanted to film one continuous chase for the entire film. He thought that'd be really great. So he kind of, you know, noodled around with that idea for a while. In 1998, the whole idea coalesced, where he felt that at this point, the hunt was no longer for oil or resources. It was for human beings, and to keep human beings, human beings became the resource. He worked with Brendan McCarthy, a comic book artist, and they wrote the screenplay. It was mostly done out of storyboards. There was 3,500 different storyboards, which is almost exactly how many shots are in the film, at the final film. So he really knew when he walked into that film what he was going to do. They were set to shoot in 2001 with Mel Gibson recurring as Mad Max. It was delayed because of September 11th. So they decided to shoot in 2003. It was delayed because of rainfall. They were going to go shoot in Namibia, Africa, but was delayed because of the Iraq War. And then in 2006, George Miller announced he was going to still make Mad Max Fury Road, but without Mel Gibson at this time because of his controversies and Miller feeling that he needed to keep the character younger. In 2008, Heath Ledger was attached to the film, but he passed away, so that moved the film again. 2009 and I think 2010, when Hardy was then announced as the person playing Mad Max. 2011, the filming was going to go again in Australia, Broken Hill. But again, just like in 2003, there was so much rain in Broken Hill that the wildflowers started growing and made the desert look very, very beautiful. So they moved the filming to Namibia and started filming in 2011. They finished, I believe, in 2012. All right, so that's basically the rundown of why.
So if it was done in 2012, why wasn't it released until 2015?
Well, part of that was there's an incredible amount of film they had to edit, and there was CGI effects. Even though like 90% of the actual driving and stunt works in the cars were done for real, there was CGI stuff like them going out and taking out the safety lines and that kind of stuff. And then there was also, they did go back and do a month of reshoots at the end of 2012, I think. And those were done in Australia. And then it was done and finished in 2014, and the studio released it in May of 2015. Sometimes you just get stuck in that that release date stuff. And there was other things that were going on too that they ended up putting away. There was going to be an anime that told you Furiosa's story when they originally were going to do it in 2008, 2009. They were getting geared up for that. And because they had to delay again, that got pushed away. That is now going to be made as a live action. Mad Max Furiosa is going to be made. It's supposed to come out in 2023. They also wrote enough stuff that it became a second screenplay called Wasteland, and that's also going to be coming out. Mad Max Wasteland is going to be coming out in 2023 with Hardy again reprising Mad Max. So there's a lot of stuff happening around this story now that he's doing it. That's the reason why it took so long to make this film. And when I went and I saw it, I was super... It's funny. When they announced it way back when, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then I would read that, no, they're not doing it. Yeah, they're doing it. No, they're not doing it. Yeah, they're doing it. And I'm like, and by the time they announced, oh, yeah, we just did it and it's coming out, because I kind of lost track of it. I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm ready for a Mad Max movie. I was like, it, where I was in my life and all that stuff. And then I went and saw it in the theater, and I could tell that I was not alone in that, because I was like five people in the theater on the opening weekend. And then we all went, oh my God, this is amazing. And you could hear the word of mouth just build for this film. And one of the reasons why was of Charlize Theron's character. Furiosa was a great character and a great foil for Max. And she's actually the dramatic heartbeat of the story. And Max is more of, ironically, kind of the, takes some of the mentorship parts. And by the end of the year, it became like one of the most talked about and liked films.
So you mentioned a lot of this history, and you did say that you really enjoyed it while you watched it in the theater. But why did you pick this film when we suggested maybe doing a retrospective on Charlize Theron?
For two reasons. One, for me, she's the dramatic heartbeat of the story. It really does kind of wrap around her. And the second reason is because not all reboot/revisits work. And especially when the original director goes back and does it. And I have to say, George Miller more than surprised me on this. He goes back to that world. He expands on it. He brings in such ideas that make it both horrific and beautiful at the same time. There's some amazingly gorgeous photography and scenes in this film. And then it's also horrific that these people are going through those experiences. So it just stuck with me. And visually, I think it's one of the best action films I've seen in the last 20 years, easy. When you brought up Atomic Blonde and we thought about doing this retrospective, this was the easy choice for me.
So what do you think is one of the most important themes about this movie?
So one of the things that surprised you was that George Miller was the person who wrote and directed Happy Feet. He wrote Babe. And then he also did Mad Max.
Yes, it was surprising to me because I love Babe. Babe was part of my childhood.
One of the things that's really important to George Miller is family and how families are created and how people create their own communities. And even in Mad Max's world, you see how people are forming different communities. Some of them may be very toxic and very top heavy, or somebody's abusing the people underneath them or something like that. But these communities are being built. And then there's always the counterbalance of a community that's being built, a family that's being built and supported in a much healthier way in these films. So that's one of the things that I feel was a really important theme in this film, was like, if you see how certain people have bonded together, there is a sense of family at the end of that. By the end of that film, there is a sense of family for a certain group of people.
So you mentioned Furiosa and a character played by Charlize Theron being the heart of this movie. How important do you think that is for the Mad Max series?
Well, it was met at the beginning when it first came out. There was some men's rights activists who were very angry that it wasn't just Mad Max riding down the road, killing people, I guess. I can't really figure out their argument, because if you go back and look at the films, the first film, Mad Max is a family man. His wife and his kid feature very heavily in that story. In Road Warrior, he's in the wasteland. It's the least human version of Mad Max. By the end, he has inkling. And then in Beyond Thunderdome, you really do see him evolve a little bit and get some redemption by helping save the kids that were lost. And in that movie, he deals with two very strong women. He deals with Tina Turner as Auntie Entity, who runs Bartertown, and she's ruthless and she's powerful. And she tries to use him to get what she wants, to get more power. There's also Savannah Nix, who is the leader of the Lost Tribe of Kids. She's like a surrogate mom, and her leading style, although just as forceful, is much more supportive and takes the kids under her wing and becomes almost like a surrogate mother figure. She has an anger, and she can be just as forceful as Auntie Entity, but she has a much different style of leading. And you have these two opposing women and their different ways of leading, which Max is at that point working in between in that story. And then when you get to this story, Furiosa is really important, because if you pull her out of the story falls apart. And it's also her growth, too. At the beginning, she's running away. At the end, she, with Max's help, she sees who she has to become and goes and faces it and goes and does it. So that's why I think it's really important. She is definitely a much more feminist viewpoint in this world. You have this toxic patriarchy being led by Immortan Joe, who literally drinks breast milk from women he's milking in a cave, to being replaced by a matriarchy with a possibly more egalitarian viewpoint. We don't know, because it ends. But it leads one to believe that.
Yeah, because when I was watching this movie, I was actually really surprised about how a usually masculine movie was not, lack for a better term, taken over by feminine energies. And I thought it was really interesting, because I read it, and I could also be reading into it, kind of this if men stepped back and allowed women to fight their own battles, then women, there would be hope for humanity, because that's kind of the reading that I felt within the story.
Immortan Joe is definitely comes from a military background. You get that sense by the way he dresses and the way that the medals and stuff that he wears. And then, of course, the women ask the question, who killed the world? And they're aiming it at him. And as being a military person, it's a very pointed question. Then there's also the fact that he controls everything in what he calls the Citadel. He controls how much water people get, how much food they get, so he can maintain in power. It's very much a very toxic environment, which is represented by the war boys. They all, and a lot of the other people, they all have, that are fighting for him, they have growths and, you know, tumors and stuff. So the toxicity is visually there too. And he has this warped sense of Valhalla and all his other things to keep people in line. And then Furiosa, who was captured and came from a different place, has worked her way up this chain of command. And then at the right time escapes with his five wives and to go take them to the green place where she's from. The first half of the film is a chase scene, and the second half of the film is a race back. Everything's happening in the middle of action, but there's a lot being said. The themes that are in all the Mad Maxes that are revisited here about ecological destruction, how humans not managing their resources properly lead to their downfall. There's the decadence of humans. Like, there's certain people who want to maintain their power and their style of living, i.e. Immortan Joe. So there's a lot of things being discussed without being discussed.
But you said it was based on a comic book. How close?
No, a comic book artist worked with him.
Well, it was also a comic book.
No.
They never published the comic book?
No, they did do some, before the movie was done, some backstory comics, but they didn't, those were actually part of this project. They weren't like based, they didn't like write a Mad Max comic book and then make a film out of it.
He worked with a comic book artist and they wrote a script, but he came up with this idea in 1987. So how much did the script change?
He had a screenplay with Mel Gibson in mind, and he wrote it with that, the character Max being in his 50s, and it was going to be Max's redemption story. He'd live and stay with Furiosa because they would find love together. All, as I stated before, all those things happened, so they didn't film it. But it's basically the same screenplay. The character that Tom Hardy is playing is basically the screenplay that he wrote in 2001 was going to film, with minor changes here and there because of his age, which tells you that Furiosa was going to be that important back then. There's a couple subtle changes with her character, but not much. You know, she was going to be the redemption of Mad Max.
So you talk about this redemption of Mad Max through Furiosa. And one of the things that they talked about in the documentary that we watched about this movie is that the only thing that they really changed about the script was the ending. Yeah. In the sense that Mad Max in the script would go with Furiosa up into the Citadel. But in the movie, Mad Max is not on the elevator up to the Citadel.
No, he walks away through the crowd and back out to the desert. Part of that iconic Western hero samurai, they're there to help facilitate the creation of the society, the protection of the society, but they are never part of the society. So that's why he walks away into the sunset.
I also kind of read it as Mad Max passing the torch to Furiosa, because, you know, within the universe, within the world, Furiosa is now in a, lack for a better term, a ruling position. She's kind of in charge now.
She's now a full-fledged leader. At the beginning, she is a leader who has power bestowed upon her, and at the end, she's a leader who has taken her power.
Yes, and I think with Mad Max walking away, kind of solidifies that. Also for the fact that even within the series, you know, Furiosa now is getting her own movie, and there was a whole project based on Furiosa. So it's kind of this, yeah. I'm passing the torch of main character to you, which I think is very poignant in today's society, but also in the evolution of the story, because from Mad Max, the first one, to Mad Max Fury Road, there's a clear evolution or de-evolution, depending on what you want to call it, of society and of this world. And I think one of the new steps for Mad Max's world is to step away.
Yeah, and that's why the next project is called Mad Max Wasteland. He's going to be out in the wasteland. And Furiosa's project is going to be different. It's not going to star Charlize Theron. It's going to be her origin story in that world, from what I understand. I have to remember what George Miller said a while ago when somebody asked him, is he a feminist? He said, of course I'm a feminist. So I started off in this making these films with all these guys, and then I found myself surrounded by very strong women who were doing amazing things, so you have to include that in your films. And so I found that to be a very telling statement. As he's doing these films over his life, and you're seeing the evolution of George Miller also in the films.
When group of women from the Green Place were fighting the war boys, there was definitely a different form of fighting.
Yeah, they worked together.
They worked together. Well, also that, and it's not as chaotic. With the war boys, the first scene that we see them in, this long, big, long chase, it's very chaotic. It's very, I'm in power now, I'm not in power now, I'm in power now, I'm not in power now, I have to get the power now, yeah, kind of aspect of fighting. But with the women, the group, and we're calling them a group of women because they're all women, yeah, there's this togetherness, there's this logic, lack for a better term, that happens throughout this.
Well, they also
fighting.
Well, they've been out on their own, and they've learned to work together as a group, and so it's just, you're just seeing their form of how they work together as a group, and like you said, it's not as chaotic. They're not so stressed out who's in power. They obviously have older people in their group that they defer to for decisions, but they also all come to decisions together. And when they decide to all go back to the Citadel to basically rescue the Citadel from Immortan Joe, and society, because they have one thing that they have seeds, but no water. The Citadel has water, but not really seeds. There's some plants growing, but obviously not a variety. And so it definitely is like, this is what we need for society to go on. It's very similar to the ending of Thunderdome, where you see the group talking about the stories around the campfire of Max. It's like Max leaves, they're surviving, they're rebuilding something, and there's going to be this story of this character, this wanderer, and that's how this movie ends. They're going to have this story in their society of this wanderer that came and helped them, and that's going to become part of their myth. Theoretically, as these societies grow and they start bumping into each other, they're going to all have these very similar myths. And then, of course, I guess to the Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces, you're going to have all these similar myths with a similar archetype, and then it's going to rebuild that mythos, the new civilization.
What is the problems with shooting with a script meant for an older actor like Mel Gibson, but casting Tom Hardy in the script?
Well, there's a couple things that pop up, and it really makes a lot of people kind of go, it doesn't fit the timeline. It doesn't fit what's going on. At this point, Mad Max and Furiosa are the same age. So she is obviously somebody who was born into this world, this post-apocalyptic world. And he, in the script, isn't. He says, I was a cop before. But if he's the same age, he wasn't in the before time. So that's the one thing that everybody points to, and they go, okay, that just throws the timeline off. But if you look at this kind of in the spirit of like Alien Covenant or Alien Prometheus, where you're revisiting the world, not necessarily making a direct sequel or a direct prequel, you're just more like, I'm going to go back into that world and discover a story and retell a story in that world. The timeline doesn't matter as much. Now, there's videos out there on YouTube that really go into how the timeline actually does work, and there's some that argue the timeline doesn't work now unless you make Mad Max the feral kid from Road Warrior, which is a very popular theory that he was the feral kid from Road Warrior, which is why he's feral at the beginning, and he's mimicking Max. It doesn't work in the story because there's so many other things that tell you that it's Max. So I don't really buy in that fan theory. I also don't get stressed out that it could be before Thunderdome. It could be after Thunderdome. It's in this nebulous place. I don't get stressed out about that because it's a post-apocalyptic made-up world. So
it doesn't have to make sense.
Yeah. So, no, but like being very tight about it has to be. Sometimes I look at people that when they say it doesn't fit perfectly into this little category over here. It's like, wait a minute. These are stories that people are telling to entertain us and inform us and talk about the human condition, whether it's Star Trek or Marvel or Star Wars or Mad Max. There's going to be little details that are different because there's different people making them and they're made at different times. So stop stressing out about it and just worry about, is that a good story? Does it fit the general universe that was created? And more importantly, in the universe that was created for that particular film, does it work? George Miller has said it's not a true reboot. It's more of him revisiting that universe, which these next two films are going to be doing too.
So, Charlize Theron, do you think that within this role that she's given, this warrior woman, for example, do you think she loses her femininity in it?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I never really thought of her as anything but feminine character in the film. I didn't think she was a woman actress playing a male part. Like it sometimes happens in action films. They basically put a female in a male's part, and you can tell that that's all they did. They didn't tweak it. And it's just like the woman running around shooting guns, saying things that guys would say, having the same reactions that guys would have. You can see her backstory in her eyes, in her acting, in the way she reacts to the story. I thought Charlize Theron did a great job bringing that character to life.
I did too. I really enjoyed her throughout the whole movie. I also thought it was very interesting that she's not the only strong woman, and there's different versions of strong women throughout this movie.
Yes.
Because usually when it comes to quote-unquote feminist movies or trying to portray feminist ideas, there's only one direction a strong woman could go, and Furiosa kind of fits in that box but kind of doesn't. But there's also like light flowy women wearing flowy Afghans in
that's the wives, but they have a sense of steel around them. They are at different points, each one of them steps up.
Yes.
And even the one that you think is going to be the one that's going to be the weak link, at the end, she steps up and tricks the other people into letting her onto the car, so she gets the other people into the car.
Yes. And so they're smart, they're logical. There's one wife who is gun knowledgeable, which is very useful in this society. There's also a woman that I don't think we think about often, but I think that we should at least give her some recognition on this podcast. There's an old woman who stays behind.
Yes, and she protects the knowledge, but she's also the one that you can tell was the one that gave them the knowledge to be these individuals in the first place.
Yes, and so she stays behind and hears the wrath of Immortal Joe and keeps their secret safe and it, in my opinion, does one of the bravest things in the whole entire movie, which is stay silent, stay behind.
Yeah, and basically keep their secret so they can't, Immortal Joe doesn't get any information out of her. No, she's very brave. There's brave women throughout the entire film.
Yeah, and I also really appreciate it that they all come in different packages of femininity, which I thought was really interesting, especially since a lot of these stories that we're seeing nowadays, it's usually only one type of woman, and it's usually like the leather-clad, combat boot, gun-toting, spitting, one-liner type woman.
Which is basically a male version.
Which is basically, you can make a male role or a female role, it doesn't matter, there's no difference, and that's saddens me because there's so much that somebody's gender can inform to a character.
Yeah, I thought they did a good job. Ironically, in the middle of all this chasing and action and all stuff, they did a good job of fitting that in there as part of the story. So it just becomes a natural part of the story, which I really enjoyed. I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of people from different walks of life have really liked this movie. And I'm really excited to see what he does with the Furiosa character. I'm also really excited to see what he does with the Max character, because now it seems like he's kind of opened up the character, not made him such an archetype. And by the end of that movie, he had become human again. He made human choices. And even him going back out to the wasteland was a very human choice.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting because I'm reading right now about feminine and masculine energy within myths. And usually it's not like about what gender the character is. It's more about like feminine energy is inside and masculine energy is outside. And I think it's very interesting. There's definitely these archetypes you see within the play, within the movie, because there's physical fights, there's mental fights, and it's all about this masculine, feminine energy working together. And I think that, you know, was a really good marriage of the both.
Yes. So the film that you picked, Atomic Blonde, which we put second because the success of Mad Max Fury Road led to Charlize Theron being able to make one of her passion projects, which is Atomic Blonde. So why did you pick that film?
Well, I picked the film because I really enjoyed it. It was an action-packed movie full of all the things that I love, which is music, bright colors, kick-ass women. And I watched it one night, and it was like 2018 instead of 2017, so like a year after this movie came out. I watched it on a small screen, and I was watching it, and I remember the credits happened. I paused the movie, went to go to the bathroom or brush my teeth or something, and I kept on thinking about how I missed an opportunity to see an amazing movie on the big screen and how disappointed I was that I just saw this amazing film, but I would probably never get to see it on the big screen.
Well, unless they make it two.
Unless they make it two, but not this movie, you know. For those who don't know, Atomic Blonde, just in one sentence, is a Cold War espionage film during the last week of the Berlin Wall.
It's very similar to some of the older Bond films and other Cold War films. This is our second one of actually taking place during the Cold War and dealing with the intelligence industry, which is hopscotch. So how do you feel this movie compares to other Cold War spy installments that you've seen?
Well, I think it's definitely a modernized version of tropes and subjects that we have seen before because, you know, most of this movie has to do with a list of soldier spies out in the east and the west of Berlin and, oh my God, if we don't get this list, somebody's going to die, which we've seen many times. You know, Skyfall was... That was pretty much what the basis of Skyfall was. I definitely do think it takes concepts that we are aware of as an audience and spins them on their head a little bit, which I think I really enjoyed. It also ups the ante a little bit. Like with Hopscotch, though there was a little bit of action, it was still very minimal and it was definitely focused on the intelligence part of spy work.
Yeah.
And this one is definitely focused on the I'm going to kill you with my gun part of spy work.
Yeah, this one, she seemed to have ulterior motives and be working in the intelligence field, but you were never quite sure what she was doing and where she was going. So sometimes you were just as much out in the cold as her handlers were on what she was doing.
Yeah, and you did mention this movie, when it first came out, was compared to James Bond, the 60s James Bond, and Jason Bourne by critics.
Yeah, and it's definitely you can see that there's definite characters, definite reactions to that style of film, because some of the characters are... responses, meaning that's not how a CIA handler would handle somebody in MI6, or that's not exactly how this would go. This is a character. This is what we feel the character response would have been. And some of them were definitely just retellings of the same type of character was used, that the archetype or the stereotype was used in this film. It might have been updated and changed, but it was basically, that's the girl character that James Bond sleeps with. She sleeps with the girl character in this movie. It's updated because there's definitely an LGBTQ awareness factor there, but it's not, other than that, it's pretty much the character that James Bond sleeps with two women, usually in every film. There's one that ends up dying. There's the one that makes it to the end. She sleeps with only one woman in this film. So, of course, this character dies.
Well, also, I think it's good to acknowledge that this movie is based on a graphic novel, a 2012 graphic novel called The Coldest City, and it is a reaction to these types of films.
Yeah, the graphic novel is actually more dealing with the intelligence, and it also has the lead character being a woman who's doing this for her country and is screwed over both by her country and the people she's going over against.
So like we said, it was a passion project for Charlize Theron and her production company. And it's good to acknowledge Mad Max in the DNA of this movie because they're both stunt-heavy movies and Charlize Theron does 95% of her stunts. And without her acting and her ability to push forward, I don't think these characters would be as big and bold as they are on screen.
She definitely makes some really bold choices in this film, which I thought were really great. And it reminded me of some of my favorite action spy movies. I really enjoyed this film because we watched it, she makes some very bold choices that were really great for an action film. And she was very believable too. Into the action that she did, they did a really great job of, she has a history of being a dancer, so she can do movement. And Charlize Theron did a great job of, and the director and the stunt coordinator did a great job of forming the action to her abilities, which made it feel very organic. And sometimes I feel sorry for some female actors out there who go into action films, because you can see that the stunt coordinator really worked with the main guy lead, and he worked really well with some other stunt coordinators and other characters. But sometimes it's like an afterthought with the main female lead going, oh yeah, do this, point a gun, point, you know, they're given very either basic things or things that don't seem natural to their character. And this one, it was obvious that they formed the action sequences around her gifts. So I really had fun watching that. The thing that took me out of the film at the very beginning was the music. I liked the music. Don't get me wrong. The music fit the scene and the style of filmmaking that they were making, but it was, all those songs were like from 83, 84, 85. The film took place in 89, and we're told these are things playing around in Berlin, and Berlin is one of those places where music is always on the cutting edge. So you have to sit there and go, these songs would be playing in clubs.
So on retro nights, because when I was doing research, one of the things that a lot of people were complaining about, especially from people who were like Cold War historians, was that in Berlin, there was initiatives to get young people to move there on the west side. So to get them to move there into the big city to get workforce, there was incentives, you know, young men who worked, moved there didn't have to join the army, things like that. So there was, it was like a hipster utopia almost. So there was a lot of films and music that, you know, was constantly changing. It was super popular. You don't know this band? It was a week ago kind of thing. So,
yeah, and it was very much the film, I think, the music was picked by the filmmakers to make old fuddy-duddies like me feel very comfortable about the 80s that they were portraying. Once I reconciled that the soundtrack was probably her character's memory, because there's a very important incident where she talks about at the very beginning of the film for a couple seconds, where she says 5 years ago in Budapest was when she worked with the other guy. And if you take that and subtract it from 1989, guess what? All those songs would have been new in 1984, 83, 84 in Budapest. So I went, okay, these are songs in her brain that mean stuff to her. And that's why we're listening to them.
Well, I also think it's really interesting that they pick songs that go with the themes of either the scene / the fight or just of the movie in general.
Yes.
Like David Bowie, his songs or his versions of songs are played constantly throughout this movie, partly because they wanted David Bowie to be a part of it, not just in the soundtrack, but also in character form and as an actor, but he declined and then died during filming. So you see all these thing, all these David Bowie songs, and they each mean some things. Like, they play David Bowie's Cat People, which, you know, could deal with, like, the anger and the frustration of the world because the world is collapsing around her no matter what she does. And so it shows these themes through the music, which
is actually a very 80s thing.
Yes, which is that's
if you watch films from the 80s and early 90s, that's a very 80s, early 90s thing where they would use songs in a montage, or maybe not in a montage, just in over a scene to help explain the emotions of the character, emotions of the scene, point something out. And because it was overused so much in the late 80s, early 90s, filmmakers kind of went away from it. So when you go back and make a retro movie like this, taking place in 1989, using older songs that explain a plot point or an emotion that the character is going through is very much set in that time. And you're almost like saying, I'm using filmmaking techniques from that era to make this film about that era.
Yes. And you see that throughout, you know, with 99 Luft Balloons is, you know, strewn throughout this movie, kind of this like call for peace song. There's Voices Carry, which is one of my favorite songs for some random reason.
Of course, they play that whenever they're killing somebody in silence.
Yeah. And, or secrets are being told, you know, a little on the nose. And I think that's one of the things that I really enjoy about this movie is because there's those lack for a better term, filmmaking Easter eggs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's called Easter eggs. Like I said, back then, films would use these songs in replacement of other filmmaking techniques to say, this is the emotion you're supposed to be feeling in the scene, or the character is feeling in the scene, or, hey, we're playing this song, so it points out this point of this scene or sequence. So it was very common, and so once I got over that hurdle, I was totally cool with it, and I really enjoyed the stylization to the rest of the film. So it just became to me like this film is very stylized. So I didn't mind that the music was stylized either. At the first very beginning, before you kind of get in the mindset of the film, when you're getting used to stylization, it was a little jarring.
I could see that, especially since there's not like a title card that's like, this is a stylized film, you know?
I mean, they kind of, I look back at it now and they kind of like threw like the way they did the credits, the way they did the opening scene, the way there's plenty of hints that this film was going to be super stylized. I just wasn't like, we watched it really at night and I wasn't catching up at that point, but 10 minutes in I had caught up to the film and it was fine.
Do you think the song choice, I know we did talk a little bit about the song choices, but do you think the song choices are important in building setting?
That's what they were using them for. And that's, like I said, the very 80s, 90s filmmaking technique. So I just kind of bought it into that time period. While we were doing research for this film was that there was some controversy about this film because she ends up having, I think of it more as an affair with another female spy. Some people call it a love interest. Her attitudes towards this character are very ambiguous. So I didn't go that far, but I did feel like it was an affair. And then this person she has an affair with ends up getting killed. And a lot of people felt that was part of the bury your gays trope, that gay people in films get killed off so they can't have happy endings. The way this film is structured for me, I kind of see their point, but on the other side, I see other points. But how do you feel about it?
Well, we're big fans of spy movies and we're really big fans of James Bond films. And one of the things that when I first watched this, it didn't even occur to me that anybody could think of this as a bury your gay stereotype, because in my mind, it's the it's not a barrier gay stereotype, it's barrier love interest stereotype in spy films, in the sense of, like, if Charlize Theron's character was a male, everything would have still happened. They wouldn't have run away together, because there's actually a scene in the movie pretty much saying, we're never going to end up together because what we're doing is pretty much a business transaction. It's nothing more than that. You're naive to think otherwise. And to be completely honest, I feel like both of those characters in that conversation are kind of telling the audience, you're naive to believe that we're in love.
I'm sorry, this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler alert, but it has to do with the structure of the film. Charlize Theron's character is playing a very dangerous game with a lot of dangerous people, and a lot of people do not make it out of this movie alive, because that's the game type of game that they're playing. It's very similar to The Bourne Identity, very similar to most James Bond films. A lot of people end up dying. And when I watched this film, I thought of the affair that she had with the other spy played by Sophia Boutella. I felt that that character gender could be interchanged. In fact, in the comic book,
her character is
a man.
It's a man. And same thing happens to him. They have a relationship. She calls him naive. She says, pack your bags. You're in and out of your head in the comic books. He's packing his bags.
He gets killed. When this death happens, I can see why somebody would say that. That this is the same trope that you see in television shows and in movies. And I can also see somebody who watches a lot of spy films go, well, this is that character. In James Bond, there's usually a woman that he ends up sleeping with who has some piece of information. She ends up giving it to him, and then she ends up getting killed for this betrayal.
Which is what
happens. Which happens in this film. So I feel like that's what the filmmakers were going for. But like I said, I can see the other point. I think if she had lived, they probably wouldn't have run off together anyway.
No, I don't think they would have ever seen each other ever again. Maybe if they came back to Berlin or some kind of communist country. But I don't think their relationship would be the same.
No, and I think it's one of those things. The spy that gets killed at the beginning that starts the whole thing, she had an affair with him too. So it's not like she has these long-term relationships.
No. And one of the things that I was researching about, because I wanted to know why a lot of people came to mind, and the thing is, a lot of the world's television watchers and moviegoers were still reeling from the 27 LGBTQ deaths that happened on screen in the latter half of 2016. So I can understand, like you said, well, I really like this character. Oh, well, they're dead. Oh, I really like this character. I see myself in them. Oh, they're dead. And then after a while, I can see why that's degrading, because it is degrading to me, because I watch those shows and things like that. And after a while, I'm just like, that lesbian couple got shot for no apparent reason, you know? And so sometimes I can understand that. It's not clear in the movie except for the quote-unquote bisexual lighting a lot of people talk about, which is the pink and the blue lights that, like, form purple, you know, like the bi flag and things like that. There's no, like, label, like, for a better term, on both of these women's characters, and there doesn't need to be, but we don't know what their relationship is because it's not stated if they are love interests or just using each other for info.
Well, like I go back to what you said. There's literally a scene where Charlize Theron tells the other spy, you're in over your head. You're wrong if you think this is anything more than an affair, or people like us don't have relationships. And the other person doesn't seem hurt by that, shocked by it, actually confirms it. And later on, when she knows she's in danger, she prepares stuff for Charlize Theron, knowing that will help her in her case. Not a love note.
Yes, not a love note, not...
And Charlize Theron also, when she's being interrogated later, comes out and says, this is just for, I was just trying to get information. And she doesn't, she has a little bit of emotion, but I'm not really sure if she's somebody who has emotion because she sees herself in that character, somebody who back when she first started, who's inexperienced versus she's experienced now, or what did she have a little, did this person actually touch her and did she have a little connection with this person? I don't think either character was going to stick together with her.
Well, even for the fact that when she's telling the operatives, the desk people, lack for a better term, interviewing her about what happened in Berlin, she says, I made contact with the French.
Yeah, but that's a euphemism.
You could say that it's a euphemism, but it also takes away all that emotion within that relationship. So you could read into that as nothing more than just.
And I think it's not the only relationship in the film where you see her playing the opposite person for information and stuff that she needs, because it happens at the end, it happens in the middle, and obviously there was the previous relationship that kind of she kind of remembers. But you don't feel like she's somebody who builds relationships for love.
One of the things that also happens within Bond films is that there's, like we said, the one girl who dies, but also the one girl who betrays. And you can make an argument that Charlize Theron's character is the girl who betrays.
Yeah.
And ends up living. So.
So that's usually how it goes. As far as a Cold War spy film, I really enjoyed it. The action was intense. You told me that when she practiced for this film, she was practicing with Keanu Reeves.
Mm-hmm. She was practicing with 8 physical trainers, and Keanu Reeves and her were studying underneath the 8-7-11 action team, which is the choreographers and the teachers that taught both of these actors their moves for Atomic Blonde and John Wick. So, and they had this like fun, according to some of the funny stories about these two people, they had like a competitive relationship and were like sparring with each other and trying to outwin each other, you know. So,
yeah, I mean, I know that she's very she's competitive. I also know she's very talented because she was the best driver in the Italian job. It when they were doing all the driving training, it came out that she would rated better than all the other good drivers in that movie. So she has the skills. And I know that David Leitch, was it Leitch or Leitch?
Leitch.
David Leitch, who directed this film, co-directed the first John Wick, although he is uncredited, and
produced the whole series.
He's a producer on the whole series. He also produced Nobody, which just came out. And so he definitely is one of those people that you can see the influence of John Wick in this film and in its action sequences, which I really enjoyed. I think that's one of the things is that when you see the work that all the stunt people are doing, the actors are doing, it really makes the experience fun.
Yeah, and I also think it's really fun that because John Wick is such a cultural moment right now, lack for a better term, because a lot of people really enjoy it. It's such a fascinating story that there's always like fan theories and stuff about how they could be in the same universe because this one dude is producing it and this one dude who was also the director was directing it. Similar to how everybody was really confused if Nobody was part of the John Wick universe when it first came out. And so I think it's really fun when something is like John Wick is in Atomic Blonde's DNA that they continue to hold on to that. I think it's really, you know, with the, maybe there's a crossover. Maybe she's his aunt, you know?
So we talked a little bit about 2 movies that Charlize Theron is in. So I ask you this question. It's a very serious question. You ready? Mm-hmm. Do you think Charlize Theron is a great action hero?
Yes.
Why?
Because she's awesome. No, I do think she's a great action hero. And I think part of the reason why I think that she's a great action hero is because she plays characters that are like we mentioned before, are women. They're not just a male character with boobs. You know, she's a woman. She lets that inform her. She lets that inform in her fighting. I think most of her characters have depth when it comes to action. And she has tough female characters who move the plot, which a lot of action females, they're usually sidelined or they don't move the plot. And I think it's really interesting that she picks movies that are challenging for her. And like she said, that she said in an interview, she tries to pick films where her character might not be liked in the first 5 seconds. And I think that's really interesting because it allows her to work really hard to get us to like the character. And I think that really shows her talent. I also think it shows she's really good at action roles and as an action hero because she chooses to listen to her body and she chooses to go, hey, I don't think I'm comfortable with this. We need to fix it. And she does a lot of, as you can tell, she does a lot of front kicks because her stunt person named Monique Granderton, she says that we do a lot of front kicks with her because she has really strong legs. And she, you know, with the old guard, she was really into asking all the actors, what were they comfortable with? What are they proud of? Things like that. So she really listens and that informs her character. And I think with the action that she does, I can see a whole world within her character. Do you think that she's a great action hero?
Yeah, I like her as an action hero, as an action star, because like all great action stars, she is very reactive and leads with her physical acting when she's in that moment. So like in Mad Max, we know that Furiosa has a backstory. I've talked about how the backstory is expressed through her expressions and her acting. So we talked about both of her movies that we watched. I'm going to ask you a question about Mad Max Fury Road. So some people consider Mad Max Fury Road one of the best action films of all time. Do you?
Yeah, I can say that with full confidence. I 100% believe. And it's not just Charlize Theron's role within the movie. It's also due to the large scale of all of the stunts. You know, they did their stunts almost 100% of the stunts were done in real time. So I think with the planning that went behind the camera and what was done in front of the camera, I could confidently say it's probably one of the best
action films of all time. Well, for me, yes, I think it's actually one of the best action films of all time. And I say that knowing what some of the other choices are out there. And I think to be a really good action film and be considered one of the best action films, it has to hold up to multiple viewings. And I've now seen this film four times in the last 5 years. Four times. And it holds up every time I discover something new. Usually it's some detail like in the car work or something now. But it's like the story is compelling enough. The questions it's asking, the acting is good. So you feel like you're part of this world and you're watching a great movie.
Yes. I also think it works really well because there's some fluidity within the movie. And I think partly that's due to the fact that they did a lot of the stunts in real time. They didn't CGI many things. And there's a lot of movies, especially now, with a lot of CGI that just makes the movie feel stunted. And a lot of the times they want to put the stunt on a pedestal. And I'm thinking about like 5 stunts right now that just took me right out of the movie because it's like, we're following a car. Oh, there's a landscape picture of the car. Now we're following the car. So there's this like chop that happens in the movies because they want you to focus on the stunt. or they have to CGI the car in. And I think with Mad Max, because of the fact that it's all done in real time, in person, there's this real life quality to this movie.
Would you recommend both of these films to people?
Yes, I would recommend both of these films to people. I think they're really good. I actually had a full-on conversation with one of my good friends about Atomic Blonde when I told him that we were going to have this movie. And he was like, oh my God, it's amazing. And I was like, yes, it is. Tell everybody. I think Mad Max Fury Road, I think I'm going to recommend it to a lot of people, especially a lot of people who like, you know, action films and like the action in action films. I think Mad Max Fury Road is for you. Doesn't get weighed down with, like, dialogue, and it doesn't get weighed down with, does this plot make sense? Oh, I don't understand this. You know, it doesn't get weighed down.
And it doesn't get weighed down by the themes. We discuss a lot of themes that go into that film, that film is discussing, and it doesn't get weighed down. They're just there. So you can watch it 100% as just an action film, or you can watch it knowing what it's talking about. All right. So that seems to be about it.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. This is our season finale, but don't you worry.
We're going to be posting small little episodes while we take our break, our B-rolls that we've been compiling during the season, quick little episodes talking about different things that we like about film. So check those out.
Yes, and follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema, or on Facebook under The Movie Log. That is where we post more. We're also taking suggestions for season two. So if you have a movie that you really want us to watch, please comment or email us at TML, A Journey Through Cinema, @gmail.com.
All right. Have a great day.
Have a great day.